Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, the cover story from this week's print edition of the New Times. See No Evil, Phoenix's Ethics Commission Hides More Than It Finds. This story was written by T.J. LeHoroux and was posted on February 11th. It wasn't a meeting he wanted, but in July 2022, Simon Ramos found himself sitting across from Phoenix City Council member Laura Pastor. Ramos was a field services superintendent with the city's street transportation department, where he oversaw the maintenance of traffic signals. During an audit, Ramos said, he found falsified work orders for jobs that weren't actually being done. He brought them to the attention of the foreman in charge of that section, Marshall Pimentel. Notes typed by Ramos and handwritten by Department Assistant Director Brianna Velez describe what happened next. Days later, Pastor told the two that Pimentel was one of her best friends from high school, lecturing Ramos and Velez that she trusts him and believes anything he says, and that he would not lie. She was basically telling me to leave her friend alone, Ramos told Phoenix New Times in an interview. Pastor did not respond to her request for comment. Ramos was incensed. That 2022 meeting kicked off a 2.5-year quest to seek accountability. Eventually, the case landed in the purview of Phoenix's newly formed Ethics Commission, a body tasked with investigating ethics complaints against city officials. The Ethics Commission turned out to be where Ramos's hope for accountability died. In a 2-2 vote on September 19th, the commission dismissed the case against Pastor with little explanation. Besides a formal and boilerplate one-page explanation posted on the commission website, along with Ramos's complaint, there are no details publicly available about how the commission reached its decision. Ramos says the commission hasn't even posted his full complaint. What's available online amounts to a hard-to-parse smattering of documents. That's not how an ethics commission is supposed to operate, said Richard Painter, a University of Minnesota law professor and former White House ethics lawyer. To have public confidence in a city ethics board, you do need public accessibility and for the public to know what's going on, Painter said. It needs to be clear to the public what happened, what the rule is, and what the commission decided and why. In Phoenix, however, opacity is the commission's default. Much of the body's work happens behind closed doors. Public records of its decisions are contained mostly in meeting minutes or one-page decision summaries, which are bare bones and written in wonky bureaucratic code rather than in plain language. The commission barely has enough members for a quorum, and most concerningly for citizens hoping for accountability in their city government, the commission has yet to sustain a single ethics complaint it has reviewed. The few citizens who follow the commission's work have found the past year positively maddening. The Ethics Commission should be at the center of public accountability and transparency, said Jeremy Thacker of Phoenix, who has been a thorn in the commission's side at meetings. It's the exact opposite. Ramos put it more succinctly. It's a smoke show. History of the Ethics Commission. The Ethics Commission is nearly a year old. Its early returns aren't encouraging. The commission began meeting last March, tasked with reviewing citizen complaints about city officials who may have violated Phoenix ethics and gifts policies. As it approaches its first birthday, the commission has little to publicly show for its work. It has held just 8 meetings and has yet to refer a complaint to the Phoenix City Council for adjudication. Only 4 of the complaints made to the commission, including the one against Pastor and a combined 3 against former City Council members Sal DeCiccio and Carlos Garcia, are available online. Phoenix residents have filed only 8 ethics complaints in 8 years. Compare that against the likes of Philadelphia, a city of comparable size, which saw 51 complaints or referrals in 2024 alone. It's a statistical improbability that we're not having the same amount, Thacker said. It's just a matter of do we care or not. Even creating an ethics commission was a slog. When the city council created the commission in 2017, Phoenix was the largest city in America without one. The council took another 6 years to appoint any commissioners, a period during which complaints entered a black hole at the city attorney's office, where they were tossed around in a game of bureaucratic hot potato. In some cases, the city attorney, who also represents city officials, was charged with investigating those same officials. What officials decided, or whether they decided anything, was unknowable unless you were willing to be an enormous pest. When a 5-member commission was finally impaneled in December 2023, it lost a commissioner almost immediately. As New Times documented at the time, Commissioner Louis Lujan had resigned as the mayor of a small Southern California town in 2010 after misrepresenting campaign finance statements. Lujan then agreed to a plea deal and was sentenced to 3 years of probation, giving up his spot on the Ethics Commission a week after he accepted it. The commission has operated with only 4 members ever since. By law, all 4 commissioners' votes are needed to refer a violation to the city council, where 7 of 9 council member votes are required to take any action. In practice, those high hurdles have prevented any ethics complaints from holding city officials to account. The Ethics Commission has worsened ethics at the city, Thacker said. Before I could call someone at city staff, and I could argue and we could discuss the issues. Now they do it in private and executive session. This has backed things up, not moved things forward. As Thacker knows from experience, once ethics complaints go to the commission, not much comes out. Born in Louisiana, Thacker came to Phoenix 12 years ago to sell software. Now retired at just 47, he was radicalized for the cause of municipality transparency when an effort to build a frisbee golf course ran into a brick wall of city bureaucracy. Still possessed of Cajun fire, he's now a mainstay at Ethics Commission meetings. One such meeting was on January 16th. Thacker and his extremely well-behaved dog, an Australian Shepherd named after British philosopher Christopher Hitchens, that accompanies Thacher everywhere, sat in a small conference room at City Hall. The commission was set to consider a complaint Thacker had brought nearly 3 years earlier against Charlie Jones, a local zoning board member. 5 minutes into the meeting, the commission broke into an executive session to discuss the complaint privately. When the executive session ended an hour later, the commission's 4 members swiftly voted to dismiss Thacker's complaint. He received little explanation. For Thacker, the lack of transparency epitomizes a larger problem. Everywhere he looks, average citizens are being boxed out. You need an appointment to do anything at City Hall, he notes, and public comment at City Council meetings has been limited to 30 minutes and placed at the end of the agenda. It's just the constant disdain that our public servants have for the public, he said. Who is on the Ethics Commission? Who are the commissioners, and what do they consider an ethics violation? We know plenty about the first question, and not enough about the second. By law, the 5-person commission must be composed of at least 2 Democrats and 2 Republicans, a balance that has been thrown off following Lujan's resignation. Without him, the people tasked with hearing civilian concerns are Commission Chair Samuel Lavis III, a Republican and Vice President of Corporate Relations and Social Responsibility at Valley of the Sun United Way. Cheryl Pietkiewicz, a Republican and Communications Instructor at Grand Canyon University. Patricia Salen, a Democrat and legal ethics lawyer and consultant, and Peter Sharipa, a politically unaffiliated vice president of sales at ZipRecruiter. Collectively, they decide what constitutes an ethics violation. Phoenix's city code is vague on the subject, requiring only that all city elected officials, employees, board members, and volunteers must maintain the utmost standards of personal integrity, truthfulness, honesty, and fairness in carrying out their public duties, avoid any improprieties in their roles as public servants, comply with all applicable laws, and never use their city position or power for improper personal gain. So far, the commission hasn't met a complaint it feels violated that standard. Phoenix spokesperson Ashley Patton said 8 complaints awaited the Ethics Commission when it began operating, and that no new complaints have been filed. Since March, the commission has shot down complaints against former City Council member Sal DiCicco for allegedly spreading misinformation on social media. A complaint against former council member Carlos Garcia for a questionable interaction with a police officer after being pulled over, and Ramos's complaint against Pastor. Ramos thought Pastor's conduct violated Chapter 3, Section 4 of the City Charter, which stipulates that neither the council nor any member thereof shall give orders to any subordinates of the city manager, either publicly or privately. The charter's prescribed punishment is removal from office. That's exactly the kind of thing that shouldn't be going on with city council people getting into stuff down at the worker level, said Painter, the ethics lawyer. Because, obviously, there's all sorts of favoritism, cronyism, you name it. Ramos explored his options vigorously. He said he went to city auditors, human resources, and the city attorney, all of whom said they don't investigate council members. Records show city attorney Julie Cray told him that the city attorney does not have this authority. In the meantime, Ramos was demoted, though records show the city offered to remove the discipline notice related to his demotion from his department files if he'd drop his complaint. "I told them to shove it," Ramos said. The city's Human Resources Department did investigate Pimentel. A draft of a report obtained by New Times did not substantiate the allegation that Pimentel was creating falsified work orders, but did find that Pimentel and another man were submitting false claims to the city's integrity line to try to get people fired. The report said Pimentel misused his relationship to city officials, as well as his perceived position of importance, in a way that has caused negative impacts to streets, personnel, morale, and well-being. Phoenix spokesperson Dan Wilson said the HR probe into Pimentel was finalized by a different investigator after the first one resigned midway through. New Times has requested the finalized version, but has not received it. Pimentel retired in March 2024, about 8 months before he was eligible to receive a pension. In his resignation letter, Pimentel complained that he had been subjected to retaliation and harassment in the workplace, which has been both targeted and severe. But Ramos still wanted an investigation of Pastor, eventually filing a complaint with the Ethics Commission about a month before the commission was impaneled. He went to the meeting in which his complaint was scheduled to be discussed, but the commission canceled it. It has canceled 4 meetings in July, August, October, and November. Ramos was unable to make the next meeting. When the commission released its boilerplate dismissal, no one from the commission or the city informed him, Ramos said. I had to look it up myself. Executive session issues. Thacker has been to several Ethics Commission meetings, though he spends much of them excluded from the proceedings while the commission goes into executive session. On January 24th, Thacker filed a complaint with the Office of Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, alleging the Ethics Commission violated open meetings law during its 2 most recent meetings. Richie Taylor, a spokesperson for Mays, declined to comment on Thacker's complaint. Thacker also told the commissioners in a February 6th virtual meeting that he would file a lawsuit against them rather than wait for Mays' decision. Thacker's chances might not be great. Greg Leslie, the executive director of the First Amendment Clinic at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law, doesn't see an issue. Executive sessions are allowed under Arizona law for particular circumstances, like discussing hiring, contracts, security plans, and discipline. If the ethics complaint is part of a disciplinary proceeding, it looks like it would be covered, Leslie wrote in an email. Yet, from an ethics perspective, not what's legally required, but what makes for good governance, the frequent use of executive sessions is counterproductive, experts say. Phoenix's commission often opts to weigh ethics complaints in private rather than in public forums. During its September, December, and January meetings, it spent the majority of meeting time in executive session, barring members of the public from hearing its discussion. Letters announcing the commission's decisions, all dismissals, are viewable online, but do not explain the commission's reasoning in each case. Painter, the former White House lawyer, said blanket secrecy is a concerning habit for an ethics commission. There needs to be a lot more information available to the public, he said. There's a strong presumption in favor of hearings involving ethics allegations against senior officials being public. At a minimum, the transcript should be available. There should be a court reporter and a transcript. John Pellicero, director of government ethics at the Mikula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University, echoed the sentiment. While he noted that some privacy measures should be taken, if you're an ethics commission, among other things, the public should expect that they would demonstrate that they believe in being as transparent as possible. When asked about the commission's liberal use of executive sessions, Leavis told New Times that, like most ethics commissions across the country, there are confidentiality provisions in place to protect the integrity of investigations and the rights of those involved. A frustrating process. To get answers out of the ethics commission, or at least to attempt it, you might have to seek them in person. Thacker has made it his mission to do just that. At the January 16th meeting, the commission considered Thacker's complaint about Jones. Thacker alleged that Jones failed to disclose the conflict of interest in 2021 while serving on the Alhambra Village Planning Committee, which makes zoning decisions before referring them to the City Council. That January, the committee heard a development proposal for a new apartment complex near some properties that belonged to Jones. According to meeting records, Jones voted for the proposal, which had the potential to increase the value of his holdings. Months later, Jones announced the sale of a property on Central Avenue for $2.43 million. Aaron Duell, an attorney who represented Jones before the Ethics Commission, argued that Jones did not have a substantial interest in the development proposal because he had already been paid $80,000 a few days before the vote took place, and that sale price of the property was already fixed. Jones did not respond to an email inquiry from New Times. A similar ethics complaint against Jones was made by former Phoenix resident Diane Michalski. Her complaint noted that the city's own ethics handbook for board and commission members spells out that it would be a violation for a board member to vote on a zoning or license application that may affect the value of the board member's property. When weighing Thacker's complaint, the commission did not seem to have considered that passage. All four members voted to dismiss the case, saying there was no violation of the city's ethics law. Thacker responded with outrage. Are we just disregarding the entire ethics handbook? Thacker asked the commissioners. Are we just going to go by the one paragraph statute as our go-to and the examples given in the handbook are meaningless? Because if so, Stop the charade of putting this up and stop holding these meetings. Pietkiewicz was puzzled as to why Thacker cared. Thank you for expressing your passion. It is very clear in your vocalizations and clearly in your writing. You have a clear desire for a particular outcome, she said, with some condescension. So my question is, why is this such an interest to you? I don't care about Charlie Jones, Thacker responded. I care about ethics at the city, the bigger picture. He noted that there has not been a single sustained ethics violation in Phoenix in a decade. This is a symptom of what's going on, he said. After that meeting, New Times asked Levis whether the body considers the ethics handbook beyond just the city code when making decisions. Three times Levis declined to give a yes or no answer, saying it was best to wait for the final report of the decision to be issued. Notably, there are no final reports for any decisions available online. I gave you an answer. It's an answer, Levis said. Call it a non-responsive answer if you want, but it's an answer. After the meeting, Levis followed up in an email. I felt bad about our interaction, he wrote, so wanted to offer a more thoughtful response to your original question. I think my obligation as a member of the Ethics Commission is to thoughtfully consider all relevant policies, laws, and regulations when a question is on the table. True to the Commission's form, it wasn't a direct answer. Next, a story written by Stephen Lemons and posted on February 13th. Glassman raised $1.3 million for Attorney General run, mostly from himself. Much as he did in 2022, wealthy agribusiness heir Rodney Glassman is running for Attorney General as a born-again acolyte of Donald Trump, making a trip to the border with Maricopa County Sheriff Jerry Sheridan and recreating Trump's McDonald's drive-thru stunt, all while looking to unseat Democratic Attorney General Chris Mays in 2026. But if some rock-ribbed Republicans remain wary of the former Tucson City Councilman and erstwhile aide to lefty Congressman Raul Grijalva, his January 15th campaign announcement gave them reason to be. In the announcement, Glassman claimed he broke the record for most funds raised in an off-year attorney general's race, pulling in more than $1.3 million. What Glassman neglected to share is that he loaned himself $1 million of that total, according to a recent campaign filing with the Arizona Secretary of State's office. Glassman initially agreed to an interview for this piece, then suddenly stopped responding to inquiries. Self-financing a campaign is nothing new to Glassman, neither is losing them. When he ran as a Democrat to unseat Senator John McCain in 2010, Glassman loaned himself $500,000. Glassman wound up winning only 34% of the vote, leaving a sour taste with Democrats, along with memories of a horrible off-key singing campaign video. Glassman pissed off a lot of Democrats who supported him after he reputedly promised he'd spend anywhere from $3 to $5 million to take down McCain. That largesse was not forthcoming, and by all accounts, Glassman ran a shitty campaign. Staffers bailed right and left, describing the then 32-year-old Glassman as a spoiled rich kid with a frat boy's sense of humor, who was prone to out-of-control temper tantrums. The remainder of Glassman's time in public life has illustrated the sunk cost fallacy. Glassman ran unsuccessfully for chair of the Arizona Democratic Party, and then switched affiliations. As a Republican, he ran for Arizona Corporation Commission and then Maricopa County Assessor, losing both times. In 2022, Glassman sought the Republican nomination for AG, losing out to now Representative Abe Hameda by 10 points. In that race, Glassman loaned himself $1.75 million per his campaign filings. His wealthy parents helped with the post-campaign debt, donating about the same amount in cash once the race was lost. Hamada went on to lose the general election to Mays by a mere 280 votes, which may be why Glassman thinks he has a shot against her in 2026. What makes Rodney run? New Times did not get to ask the University of Arizona law grad about the nature of his inherited wealth, which has made him the Harold Stassen of Arizona politics. But a former campaign staffer has insights to share. Glassman is the scion of the Britz family, which a 2002 Los Angeles Times story described as running a multi-million dollar empire that includes a petrochemical company, packing houses, a cotton gin, and tens of thousands of acres of irrigated cropland. That's given Glassman access to a near endless supply of money to finance his political aspirations. Tucson Sentinel reporter and political columnist Blake Morlock worked as communications director on Glassman's 2010 run against McCain. In a 2018 column, Morlock revealed that Glassman had a guaranteed income of $300,000 per annum. The writer told New Times that he remembered going over the details with Glassman at the time, and that the $300 was yearly interest on Glassman's trust fund. That amount absolutely may have changed since 2010, Morlock said. In fact, if the amount hasn't changed, somebody's being stupid. The markets have quintupled or quadrupled since then. Morlock suggested that Glassman shares Trump's flexible ideology and quest for acclaim and political office. Glassman is Trump without the charm, Morlock cracked, warning that the former boss lacks any core beliefs. So do many, if not most, successful politicians. Glassman is just missing the successful part. So, why does he keep running after so many disappointments? One prominent Valley Republican, who asked not to be named, joked that Glassman is the type of person who runs out in front of parades and pretends to be the Grand Marshal. Republicans may like Glassman's volunteer work with the Boy Scouts, his service as an Air Force reservist, and his multiple advanced degrees, despite accusations that Glassman plagiarized his doctoral dissertation. But they also view him as a pest. This local GOP rainmaker said Glassman is constantly asking him to support his campaign, and he knows of other Republicans who have given Glassman money just to make him go away. The anonymous Republican hasn't done likewise, at least yet. Despite Glassman's war chest, the GOP operative thinks likely primary opponent Arizona Senate President Warren Peterson will probably pants Glassman in 2026. Of course, that would just leave Glassman ready to run again. There's something that makes him need this, said the Politico. Somehow, it's like his whole existence would be validated if he just made it into office. Weird. Justin Heap takes credit for firing staffers who left before he took office. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and posted on February 12th. New Maricopa County Recorder Justin Heap did not fire six communication staffers after taking office, even if he's talking as if he did. Roughly a month after taking over for former recorder Stephen Ricker, Heap has been quick to boast about performing his everyday duties as if they were major accomplishments. In a press release issued on February 7th, he made a point of taking credit for personnel changes that happened before his term began. In the release, Heap criticized Ricker's lack of organizational leadership and over-focus on external political communications. Ricker and Heap are both Republicans, though Ricker became a target of the MAGA wing of the party for shooting down the same kind of election denialism that Heap and his allies have espoused. As a result, Heap's release said he eliminated the salaries and positions of 6 external communications officers to free up resources for needed improvements. The inference is that he fired them, which is how news outlets, including the Associated Press, took it. The truth is that all 6 of those staffers resigned before Heap assumed the position, and that Heap has merely chosen not to backfill their positions. Phoenix New Times asked Heap's office for the names of the 6 communication employees whose positions were eliminated. In response, Heap's chief of staff, Sam Stone, offered a no comment and directed New Times to submit a public records request. New Times submitted such a request, asking for the names of the 6 staffers Heap fired. Heap's office responded, "There are no responsive records, as the 6 employees resigned from their positions before January 6, 2025, the date on which Heap was sworn in. In response to a subsequent records request, Heap's office provided the names of the former employees. The first to leave was Marcus Millam, a former communications officer and government liaison. He resigned after accepting a job in his preferred field in late September, according to Recorder's Office records. Next was communications manager Sierra Ciramella, a former creative director for Governor Doug Ducey, who resigned as communications manager in late November. 2 more staffers, communications department officer Taylor Kinnerup and management assistant Diane Siebenaller, resigned in the first 2 weeks of December. On January 3rd, the remaining 2 resigned. As their jobs were below manager, their names were redacted as per policy, according to Heap's office. Heap was sworn into office the following Monday, January 6th. It's not clear if any staffers resigned because Heap was taking over. New Times has requested the resignation letters for all 6, but has yet to receive them. New Times also sent questions to Heap's office, but has not heard back. Trouble with the facts. The exodus of communication staffers isn't the only subject on which Heap has overstated the facts. In January, Heap crowed about culling thousands of inactive voters from the voter rolls, as if he were instituting a huge cleanup. In fact, he was performing the same statutorily mandated duties as his predecessors. Earlier this month, Heap announced a new measure to allow observers into the room where ballot envelope signatures were verified. Others, including Ricker, pointed out that had already been happening. Heap's allies have also railed against a shared services agreement between the Recorder's Office and the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors that was signed months before Ricker left office. The terms of that agreement weren't particularly controversial. It moves office IT functions under the county umbrella and moves certain ballot processing jobs to the county elections department, which processes ballots. But MAGA types have painted the agreement as an effort to neuter Heap before he took office. On February 10th, self-described MAGA investigative journalist Brian Ferenze posted the text of an email supposedly sent by new county supervisor Debbie Lesko, who voted against certifying the 2020 election while in Congress, and who was certainly not anti-MAGA. In the letter, Lesko laid out that she voted for Heap and has met and talked with him several times since his election, and has asked him to submit to me in writing exactly what he wants. So far, I have not received that. New Times has asked Lesko's office to confirm the authenticity of that email, but has not heard back. However, on February 11th, Lesko tweeted that she had received a written request from Heap about changes he wants to make to the shared services agreement. New Times has requested that written request, but has not received it. The Maricopa County Recorder's Office oversees voter registration, the mailing of ballots, and more than 50 million public records in the county, according to the office's website. However, the most election-related duties, including the tabulation of ballots and in-person voting, are handled by the County Elections Department. Here's a story written by Emma Patterson of Cronkite News and posted on the Phoenix New Times website on February 14th. Arizona sheriffs want no part of Trump's immigration crackdown. Arizona sheriffs haven't been ordered to help yet with President Donald Trump's immigration crackdown, and many would like to keep it that way. "We're not going to go out and actively try to hunt people down," said Graham County Sheriff Preston Alred. "We have never done that. We don't do that type of stuff. There's just nowhere in my duties or responsibilities as the sheriff here that I should be involved or engaged in migrant roundups," Pima County Sheriff Chris Nanos said. "That's not what we're here to do." Trump's vow to detain and deport everyone in the country without valid documents, at least 11 million people, including 273,000 in Arizona, according to the Migration Policy Institute, thrilled supporters during the campaign. "If you have laws, they shouldn't be there and be ignored," Joe Arpaio, the former Maricopa County Sheriff, said by phone Tuesday. "When I was sheriff, I enforced all of the laws." Once known as America's toughest sheriff, Arpaio, now 92, received the first pardon that Trump issued in August of 2017 for a misdemeanor that carried 6 months in jail. His crime? Disobeying a federal judge's order to stop racial profiling in detaining individuals suspected of being in the U.S. illegally. Migrant advocates say Trump's deportation pledge has fueled distrust of local law enforcement, whether they've been enlisted in the effort or not. "We already have enough need for them to protect property and individual humans," said Jose Patino, Vice President of Education and External Affairs at Aliento, an immigration advocacy group. "To me, it's another way for distrust in local communities and policies to boom." Some sheriffs, including Coconino County's Brett Axland, share that concern. Through an aide, the sheriff said he is extremely concerned that community members will be afraid to report crimes or interact with law enforcement if the department enforces immigration law. Forcing cooperation. Republicans in the Arizona legislature are taking steps to force police departments and the 15 county sheriffs to help with federal enforcement. Last week, State Senate President Warren Peterson, Republican of Gilbert, proposed a bill that would require every law enforcement agency in Arizona to sign agreements with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement and to use its best efforts to support the enforcement of federal immigration laws. Only four Arizona departments have such agreements, known as 287G, according to ICE: Yavapai, Pinal, and La Paz counties, and the city of Mesa. Each jurisdiction has agreed to house detained migrants and have ICE-trained detention officers identify inmates who might be subject to deportation. None agreed to another available option for ICE to train their officers on enforcing federal immigration statutes. "We are going to agree to house individuals for ICE if they're determined to be detained and deported," said La Paz County Sheriff William Ponce. "I will always work with my federal partners," said Pinal County Sheriff Ross Teeple, who noted that ICE doesn't need to use his jail because it has plenty of beds at its own nearby detention facility. Sheriffs don't answer to the White House or Congress, but they do answer to the legislature. "Law enforcement officials are state entities," said Angela Banks, a vice dean at the Arizona State University Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. "The federal government cannot direct state and local agencies, unless there are agreements between both sides." In Pima County, which spans more of the border than any other in Arizona, the sheriff said his department has no problem providing backup when the Border Patrol needs it. But that's as far as he'll go. "We will assist them, of course," Nanos said, "but we're not doing their job." He and other Arizona sheriffs and their departments are already stretched thin and don't want their deputies saddled with immigration enforcement. Proposition 314 effects. That workload is likely to expand anyway, under Proposition 314. The measure, approved nearly 2-1 by Arizona voters in November, makes it a crime under state law to cross the border illegally. It also lets state judges order deportation, traditionally a federal authority. These provisions are on hold pending a ruling from the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals on a similar Texas law known as SB 4. A number of Arizona sheriffs opposed Proposition 314, and many said that they'd struggle to enforce it. The current president of the Arizona Sheriffs Association, Yavapai County Sheriff David Rhodes, said sheriffs recognized the frustration that led voters to approve it, though. It mandates local law enforcement to do a federal job because the federal government was not doing it. They were flat out not doing it, he said. The ACLU of Arizona, which also opposed Proposition 314, predicted that the measure will incite the discrimination and harassment of immigrants. Several sheriffs interviewed by Cronkite News noted that Proposition 314 allows them to be selective about enforcement, leeway they may not have if they're required to enforce federal immigration law. On Monday, the State House Public Safety and Law Enforcement Committee approved a bill that would provide $50 million to help beef up border security and immigration enforcement by state and local agencies. Not our job. With or without fresh funding, though, Nano said he wants no part of immigration enforcement. But finding, detaining, and eventually deporting 11 million people will require more resources than the federal government has. The Trump administration knows full well that ICE doesn't have that capacity to accomplish the plan that the administration wants, Patino said. To achieve Trump's goal in the next 4 years would certainly require cutting corners. He added, they would have to engage in racial profiling. Tactics of that sort when Arpaio was sheriff prompted a class action lawsuit in 2007 in Maricopa County, where Arpaio, elected 6 times, served from 1992 to 2016. He gained national renown for implementing labor chain gangs, erecting the infamous Tent City, and making prisoners wear demoralizing outfits. The department has been under court supervision since 2013 and has been barred since then from enforcing immigration law. The new Maricopa County Sheriff, Jerry Sheridan, elected last fall after 40 years with the department, including service as Arpaio's chief deputy, has distanced himself from Arpaio's legacy. He promised a community advisory board that he doesn't plan to enforce Proposition 314. Arpaio, a Trump ally, defended the hardline approach as the best deterrent. I put tents up. It was a popular program, he said. 500,000, including illegal aliens, went in those tents. If there is a will, there is always a way to get the job done. A travesty. Echoing Trump, Scottsdale guts its diversity office. This next story was written by T.J. LeHeroux and posted on February 12th. Tuesday night at a Scottsdale City Council meeting, Don Logan looked on in dismay. Nearly 3 decades ago, Logan was tasked with getting a diversity office off the ground in Scottsdale. This was a new venture among Valley cities, and the going was often tough, so tough that he nearly gave his life for it. In 2004, 6 years after the city founded what was then called the Office of Diversity and Dialogue, a package arrived at the office. When Logan opened it, a pipe bomb exploded, nearly killing him. A subsequent investigation showed that the package had been sent by white supremacists, enraged by the mere idea of diversity. Logan survived that brush with death, but 20 years later, the office he built was sentenced to an ignominious demise. Tuesday night, the Scottsdale City Council voted 5-2 to gut the department Logan built, now called the Office of Diversity and Inclusion. There was no apparent justification for doing so, other than for the council to align itself with Donald Trump's baseless culture war crusade against diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. I gave my blood for this organization, Logan told Phoenix New Times about the diversity office. If I hadn't opened that package the way I did, I wouldn't be here. To have this group of electeds come along and whitewash it the way they're doing it tonight is a travesty. Created in 1998, the city's diversity office has two employees who are charged with keeping the city compliant with anti-discrimination laws and the Americans with Disabilities Act. Those two employees will be reassigned to other city departments. Logan spoke at the meeting, along with dozens of other residents enraged by the city's move. The meeting was uncharacteristically packed with hundreds of residents standing along the chamber's perimeter. This is bullshit, one person shouted, while others mumbled similar expletives. Shame on you, residents began chanting. During the public comment section of the meeting, at least 45 people spoke out against the change in ordinance. Only two voiced support for it. Ann Leiter, a Scottsdale United Methodist church pastor and employment lawyer, noted that diversity is a tested corporate strategy. Bias is real, and we need to address it so that we can hire the best people, she said. Companies that prioritize DEI tend to have happier and more innovative employees, higher retention rates, and are better at problem solving. Several speakers, including Hispanic Chamber of Commerce CEO Monica Villalobos, argued to the council that hiring based on merit and valuing diversity are not mutually exclusive. Merit must include access, Villalobos said. Please don't stop the momentum. Others lambasted the move as nakedly dogmatic. How do I know that this is all about ideology? Asked resident Andrew Scheck. Monday, I called the Department of Diversity and I asked them, how many people from the city council called you to understand what this department does? Scheck said the answer he received was just one, Marianne McAllen, who voted against gutting the office. Howls and applause ensued. Logan, who is now the director of Phoenix's Equality Opportunity Department, agreed with Scheck. What's troubling about this is the council, to my knowledge, hadn't even asked about what this office does, Logan told New Times. This is clearly political. What saddens me is Scottsdale has always taken a leadership role and been on the cutting edge. This tonight is nothing more than being a puppet for D.C. A solution in need of a problem. The battle against DEI has primarily been pushed by new council member Adam Quassman, previously a state legislator known mostly for derailing his political career with a hilarious on-camera gaffe. Quassman has painted DEI initiatives, which are about giving underrepresented demographics a fair shake, as abhorrent to American values. You can't walk into Scottsdale City Hall without being bombarded with DEI, Quassman tweeted on January 23rd. This poison will be rooted out of our beautiful city. In the picture accompanying Quassman's tweet, he'd circled city brochures depicting people of different racial backgrounds standing together. Quassman and Mayor Lisa Borowski, who both won election on right-wing campaigns, have pushed the council into becoming mega-lite, as one resident at the meeting described the council. For most of the public comment portion of the meeting, Quassman stared intently at his computer screen. He did not address a question about Logan, whose life was almost taken by white supremacists as he worked against discrimination. Reached by New Times, Quassman would not comment directly on the measure's widespread unpopularity among Scottsdale residents at the meeting. I cherish and will fight for all Scottsdale residents to speak their mind on every issue, Quassman said. Before the city voted to nuke the diversity office, two council members attempted to win a stay of execution. McAllen and Councilmember Solange Whitehead proposed a work-study session to discuss the actual problems the city faces by having a diversity office. That idea, to understand better what eliminating the office would mean, was shot down by five other council members. Speaking at the meeting, Whitehead said the vote was hypocritical. The supposed goal of eliminating the diversity office was to ensure Scottsdale hired solely based on merit. Whitehead said the city already does that. I've got good news for you. For as long as I've been in Scottsdale, and for long before that, this city has been a merit-based hiring city, Whitehead said. This ordinance was done behind the scenes, without a public process, and serves no purpose. Whitehead also warned that the ordinance eliminating the office is aimed at accomplishing nothing and solving problems that never existed, and, sadly, sends a message to the world that this international destination is not open for all. The ordinance's passage will slash DEI programming such as workplace diversity training, which makes up a minuscule portion of the city's spending. The total annual funding for the program, including salaries for the two employees, is a little more than $700,000, according to City Treasurer Sonia Andrews. Beyond that, it's not clear what else will change in Scottsdale. The city will still need to enforce any discrimination laws, and it will still need to ensure ADA compliance to avoid lawsuits. With the diversity office's two employees being reassigned, that work may continue in some form. What's certain after Tuesday is this. By eliminating a groundbreaking office that withstood violent threats to its mission, Scottsdale's new right-leaning city council managed to piss off a lot of people. The program continues now with this story written by T.J. LeHeroux, posted on February 10th. She lives! Phoenix parody account Thelma Johnson rises from the dead. She is risen. Months after baseless speculation overtook the internet that the real Thelma Johnson was dead, one of Phoenix's top parody social media accounts is back. On Sunday, the account tweeted for the first time since October 18th, sharing a very simple message. Fuck Elon Musk. Phoenix New Times named the real Thelma Johnson the best political Twitter parody account of 2023, and for good reason. The account is known for roasting MAGA politicians like Donald Trump and Arizona's own Carrie Lake, creating original memes using Photoshop, and making hilarious use of its fiery, grandmotherly character. The real Thelma Johnson boasts a following of 100,000 people on X. So, is she really back now? New Times sent a direct message to the account to ask about its return and inquire about whether the account plans on migrating to other social media platforms, considering its criticism of Musk and X. Whoever runs the account, who, to be clear, is almost certainly not an old woman, has not responded. Before Sunday, Arizona's favorite Meemaw last tweeted in October, posting a screenshot from an Engadget article explaining how X would be giving data to third parties to train their AI models. A month after that tweet, a social media user named Art Candy claimed to have heard heartbreaking news that Thelma Johnson had died. Yet Candy, nor anyone else, could rustle up any actual evidence of corroborating details, like a cause of death or a date. Some official media users recalled a post from Thelma Johnson's account from one of her sons, sharing the news of her death, but no such post has been reproduced. It's worth remembering that the account's profile picture is either a stock photo that has appeared on a number of websites, or an image of an Ohio woman who died in 2018. Whoever runs the account, it's not clear, said that they had grandchildren in a June interview with Kathy Sigmund of Civic Engagement Beyond Voting. But it's impossible to know whether they are genuinely serious or method acting. If the person running the account is indeed a grandparent, their Photoshop skills are particularly impressive. Whether the Fuck Elon Musk missive was a one-time shriek from beyond the grave, or a sample of more tweets to come, it's good to have one of Arizona's top shitposters back, for however long it lasts. As we near the end of the program, here's one more story, written by Morgan Fisher, posted on February 14th. No kings on President's Day. Protest at the Capitol. What to know? Spurred by Reddit, protests occurred throughout the country on February 5th to demonstrate against the Trump administration's policies and Project 2025. The movement was dubbed 5051, a nod to the effort to organize 50 protests in 50 states on one day. In Arizona, hundreds gathered in front of the Capitol to communicate their anger and displeasure about the Trump administration's actions, its immigration crackdowns, shuttering of federal agencies, and the unleashing of billionaire Elon Musk to disrupt the flow of federal funding. Now, the 5051 movement is at it again, planning another Capitol protest on Monday, February 17th, which is President's Day, or, as the protest is calling it, No Kings on President's Day. Here's what you should know. In Phoenix, the protest will take place at 12 p.m. on Monday, February 17th. Similar protests are planned at different times across the country. The protest is at the Arizona Capitol in downtown Phoenix. The address is 1700 West Washington Street, Phoenix, 85007. You can get involved through the Reddit channel r/5051. That's 50501. The Arizona protest also has a new Instagram account that's sharing information about Monday's protest under the handle @AZ50501. And that does bring us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Stay tuned for additional interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.